CSI and the World. I'm John Batchelor. Australia. Anthony Albanese is the Prime Minister of Australia. The news is that Mr. Albanese is intending to travel to Beijing to have a respectful conversation with the leadership, including Xi Jinping. This opening is said to have been launched by conversations on the sidelines of the G20 meeting in Delhi. Why? Australia has prospered these last years with orders from China. However, recently, we're told because the previous government demanded facts about the COVID-19 origin, China has been visiting various kinds of embargoes. Chiefly the one I'm familiar with right now is wine embargo, and Anthony Albanese wants to reopen trade. However, Gregory, you observe that all population is not the same. Right now, Australia is going through a bad patch, and this has some connection to its population. And yet, on the facts of it, it's grown more than 500,000 in the last reporting period, which is large for a small state. Why is that not a plus for Anthony Albanese and for the people of Australia?
Well, let's first address the China situation briefly, because that does play into it. Australia's exports to the People's Republic of China have been diminishing and will diminish dramatically over the next year or two, largely because demand from the People's Republic of China is declining dramatically for Australia's key exports of iron ore, natural gas and the like. So essentially, Prime Minister Albanese is trying to wring a little more economic benefit out of the People's Republic of China before Beijing's economy is no longer able to be meaningful to Australia or to many other countries in the world. Now, Australia had a relative economic and strategic advantage over the entire region until quite recently. A couple of decades ago, for example, the Indian GDP was only marginally higher than the Australian GDP. So Australia's per capita wealth and GDP was astronomical compared to India's. Now, per capita, it still is, but the Indian economy as a whole is now, you know, something double, almost triple the size of Australia's. Indonesia's economy similarly was and still is less than Australia's, but 20 years ago, the Indonesian economy was dramatically smaller than that of Australia. And now it's gaining very clear, and it's very close to the Australian GDP. And the same story is repeated throughout the region. Now, the Australian response has normally been where we've got this huge country, most of which is totally arid, and we have to grow our population so that other countries don't start eyeing our empty quarters and think that they can invade. And secondly, so that we can grow our population to compete with the rest of the region. Well, look, you know, Australia has now a population of 27 million. And how is that going to ever compete with Indonesia, with India, with even Vietnam or the People's Republic of China? It's just not even going to get close. So you can't compete on population size. What Australia always did and why it excelled and was always ahead of the region in technology, industry, military power and the like was because it had a more efficient, cohesive population and a more productive population. That has now disappeared. And with the addition in the year to the end of March this year, when it added 563,000 more people, all that did was to lower the per capita GDP. In other words, you splitting the same pie with an additional 500,000 people. Now, can these people at some stage contribute to the economy? Absolutely. Most of them, however, will not contribute in the short term. Some of them will. Some of them will take as long as a decade or into the next generation before they materially add to the productivity of Australia. Because the Albanese government in particular, and we see this in the United States as well, is not encouraging immigration as it did in the past, based on skill sets and language capability. It's just building up numbers of people, largely in the belief that these larger numbers, who will be poorer, will become dependent on the government and will vote for the Labor government or the left-wing government. So it's not about building Australia's wealth through the addition of compatible immigrants. Quite the contrary. It's about building people who are not coming to Australia, or conversely not coming to the United States, because they're attracted by freedom, but rather they are coming to the countries because they want handouts. In other words, they want the already wealthy parts of the population to subsidize them once they come into the country. So Australia is now entering a point where its entire ethos and culture is being changed because it's become, quote, a multicultural society, not in the sense that they're bringing peoples together so that they can harmonize, but rather bringing people into the country so that they will remain in embattled or isolated cultural groups. So this is not doing anything for Australia as a strategic power. Yes, the Albanese government is spending more on defence, although that's slowing down a little bit, predictably, because they were going to get it from 2-3% of GDP on defence. That's dampening down a little. But yes, they're spending more on defence, but they can't recruit enough people into the armed forces, regardless of the fact that they're bringing in, as we saw this year, 500,000 more immigrants.
Gregory, it's remarkable how the story that you're presenting in Australia, the challenge for the people who are immigrants and the challenge for the government, how remarkably that resembles the same story in Italy now with Giorgia Meloni dealing with overwhelming numbers from Tunisia to Lampedusa, a small island off of Sicily. They're overwhelmed. The whole island is overwhelmed with people who've arrived without skills, without language, escaping wherever they're coming from, trafficked by gangsters. And the same story, although smaller numbers, in the UK, people crossing the English Channel. And as you said, we go to the Mexican border with the United States and down to the Panama-Darien Gap. The same thing is happening. People are coming from countries without resources, without language, coming to Italy or Great Britain or the United States or Australia, expecting better lives. But better lives how? What does this do for the nation? And I see that all these nations are dealing with these stories separately. Are they talking to each other, Gregory?
I don't think so. I think this is a natural tendency of urban-based political groupings. And what we've got in the United States, for example, is an urban-based party in power, and in Australia, the same, an urban-based party in power. And they are not thinking in terms of the overall national good. They're thinking in terms of voting blocks. So the difference between the US and the UK and the US at the moment is that Prime Minister Albanese has made this flood of unqualified immigrants possible legally, whereas in the UK and the US, the governments are either resisting or not resisting this immigration, which is being done illegally into the UK and US. So the Albanese government is determined to change the character of Australia so that the Australian that the American public came to love in World War II, for example, is disappearing. Prime Minister Albanese has on October the 14th called a referendum to what they're calling the Voice to Parliament, which is to create essentially a separate parliament for Indigenous Australians. And now this violates the Australian Constitution because it says that everyone has to be treated equally. And this actually does nothing to improve the lot of the Australian Aboriginal population, but it does start to change the nature of the society. Now, if that referendum on October 14th was to succeed, which Albanese has promised a further referendum on abolishing the monarchy in Australia. Now, it's unlikely, however, as we're now seeing from polls yesterday, that this voice to Parliament is going to succeed. And if that does not succeed, Albanese is probably not going to risk a second referendum, which would also fail. Despite the popular opinion, and the last time the referendum on a republic was defeated overwhelmingly, with almost 60% of the population saying, we're not going to abolish the monarchy. And I think the sentiment in favour of the monarchy is now actually higher in Australia. So Albanese is nonetheless blatantly pushing an agenda which the public of Australia have already rejected. So, and yet they're persisting in this and trying to circumvent, if you like, the will of the Australian population by literally increasing that population with people who the government hopes will be dependent on it and vote the way it wants.
A detail about who is coming. At the Panama-Darien Gap, increasing numbers this year, this is fresh, of Chinese nationals coming from the mainland, singles in groups, making their way to flying to South America. There are several states that take you without an entrance visa. You apply when you arrive. And traveling through Central America to the United States. Does Australia see Chinese nationals coming from the mainland?
Oh, yes. Particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, you see huge Chinese populations. Yes, there are some people in that who are still answering to the Communist Party of China, but most of the Chinese, and particularly in the last year or so, who are fleeing mainland China, genuinely believe in, they want to go to a free country where they can live and prosper. And like the Vietnamese migrants to the United States and Australia, they have proven to be incredibly valuable immigrants to these Western societies. They've learned the languages. They have become very efficient. They are academically outperforming most Australians and Americans in their respective countries. So there are some very positive aspects to immigration, and most Australians are very happy with that. But what they don't want to see, as the United States doesn't want to see, is the character of the country changed dramatically by immigration, but rather to absorb people into the ideals which made their respective countries the noble ideals that they have been for many people in the world.
There was one young man, a Chinese national by himself, who entered into the Darien Gap with not carrying water, not carrying food, walking those 60 miles with a trail of people in front of him, behind him. He was fed and taken care of by some children. I saw it on the video. And he made it all the way through to the Darien Gap by himself. He had English. He had some English, and he was learning English, although he wasn't learning it from the children who were feeding him because they were Spanish speakers. But in any event, he's very skinny with big horn-rimmed glasses. And when asked where he was headed, he said California. That's all he knew, to go to California, because he has friends in California. It was quite charming. You don't know the end of the story, but you do know that when young people like this arrive, they're clearly ambitious. You don't go through 60 miles of triple canopy jungle if you don't have an idea where you're going. And so I took heart from that, Gregory, because as you say, all immigrants are not the same. And one young man can turn into a success story where another young man can have a disappointing life. If there's no controlling it.
Absolutely. And it's when people march to the drums of freedom rather than marching to the humdrum of handouts that we see a difference in outcomes.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We're headed to the King Charles Report, or in this case, King Charles, and I'm going to have a Prince of Wales twist. Prince of Wales in America. This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.